Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Runner's World podcast with me, Rick Pearson.
Me, Ben Hobson.
And me, Jane Maguire.
Today, we're looking at 8 of the biggest running myths. And we're going to try and bust them for you right here on the podcast.
It's what we do.
The team's back together. We're here to bust myths.
Just myth busting. Absolute myth busters, the bunch of us.
Need to get that on a Twitter profile, don't we? Myth buster.
Oh, I mean, we've done one podcast on it, so I mean, I'm not sure.
True,
if
our credentials. You don't want to kind of overstate our sort of credentials
our power
in this area.
Yeah. I feel like if we go down this road, then we kind of like you drift into the territory of like that guy who just tracks down every single person that's ever cheated in a race.
Oh yeah,
and like publicly shames them. You get into that sphere of running, but no, we're going down the other route, which is trying to help people who perhaps have been told one thing
exactly.
It's not true.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Try and sort of clear up a few things. I'll start, and then we can go through individually what these are. But number one is the idea that heel striking is for the slow and unskilled, and I think that's something that's come out of probably Born to Run, and there's been a bit of a legacy of you're a heel striker. Oh, I'm sorry, you know. Sorry to hear that.
I also think that that's part of like shoe technology. I'm gonna put some blame onto the period of life when pronation was considered the devil's work.
Yes.
And that sort of stuff. So there's, you know, it's twofold there.
Yeah, I think that's true. It's there was a little study that kind of proved this wrong. It was 2018 World Champs, so full of elite runners, to marathon runners in the men's and women's marathon. And in the men's, they found that 67% of the men landed on the heels, 21% on the midfoot, and only 3% on their forefoot. And pretty similar in with the women's race as well. So kind of like we're talking about elite runners here, the majority of them heel strike, and only about 3 or 2% in either race actually forefoot strike. So it's not necessarily something that is an elite quality. Maybe it's actually the opposite.
Yeah, I mean, I think that heel striking has always been placed in sort of this almost cartoonish element of like you're driving your leg, a straight rigid leg, into the ground as hard as you possibly can with your heel first, and it immediately shatter every single bone in your body.
but
I mean, the reality is that a heel strike is that if it's that even if it's the lightest of touches and it's your heel first, which is part of the gait cycle, then that's efficient. And also where you land, your foot lands in relation to your center of mass, and all these sorts of things come into it. So anyway, heel striking, yeah, it's very much part of an elite gait cycle. And you know, it's because if you land predominantly on the especially off your forefoot, your calves do a hell of a lot of work. So, you know, there's a lot to be said for the heel touching down, at least.
The heel touch. Maybe we should be calling it heel touch rather than heel strike.
Strike's got a lot of power to it, hasn't it?
Yeah, and it sounds destructive, doesn't it? Whereas
like a missile strike.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's controversial, but I don't think people should worry too much about stuff like this. Do you know what I mean? Like
100%.
When you start running, and I think we've probably written this, so sorry to Andy and everyone I'm going to slag off at the magazine, but we always say, oh, go and get your gait checked. Does it really matter? Unless you've got like a mental gait, or you're like running in a really bizarre way that's going to injure your body, chances are you're probably not going to be running very far because you'd get injured. So if you've been running for like 30 years, why are you worrying about your heel?
Yeah, that's true.
Why are you worrying about whether you pronate a little bit? Just run. Is that bad? Is that bad advice?
No.
But you kind of,
I think you kind of caveated your own reasoning, but you said that if you've been running for a long time and you're going okay, then there's not need to worry. I think that's true. If you're brand new to running, there's nothing worth. There's nothing wrong with having your gait analysed, because someone might pick up that actually you might need to just, you know. I mean,
you might need a special shoe.
If I started playing tennis tomorrow and just went out and started trying to, you know, do tennis as well as I possibly could, I would go and get lessons. So I kind of like, you know, running lessons.
Yeah, that's a
kind
fair point.
Kind of do exist. Go to a, you know, track and train with people, and they'll teach you how to sort of like train and run. And I think that running efficiently is part of a running lesson. So I would kind of like meet you in the middle and say that.
Yeah, I think running's a skill, Ben, isn't it? I think the one thing I say, if anyone's new to running, I do think there's something to be said for getting out there and running, rather than like things like gait cycles and stuff, which can be really useful in the long run. They are one more thing you've got to do before you start running. Do you mean? Whereas actually, if you're a bit like, you've got a pair of shoes, why don't you go out there and see how you feel? And then look, maybe we can go and talk about the gait cycle and into the specifics of stuff slightly later down the road.
Yeah, but it's also like, I can't remember his name. He's won everything. He's super fast. This is a really boring point because I can't remember his name. But he dramatically overpronates.
This is like Cheptegei, isn't it? Ugandan, yeah.
And it's awful. Like, his ankle has literally collapsed. And it's like, well, he's one of those records. So, do you know what I mean? Yeah. But if he went to bloody runner's need, wouldn't he? They'd put him in a stability shoe. And imagine what that would do to him, poor guy. It'd slow him right down. So it's a bit of me. It's like, don't stress. Stress less, but then, if you're a beginner, do stress.
So,
fantastic advice.
I'm hoping we're bringing this kind of clarity to all the points for people. I think they're
this kind of confusing argument. Confusing. I have not really thought through.
Everyone being slightly in the middle, unsure. No, so heel striking is for the slow and unskilled. We can absolutely bust that, man.
One myth busted right there.
Great.
Moving
great.
On.
Thank you. Next.
All right. myth number two. Static stretching before a run is bad. New research suggests that both static and dynamic stretching pre-run can decrease perception of effort and increase performance compared with no stretching at all. Both static and dynamic stretching were investigated in the study, published in the Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health. Great journal. The researchers wanted to find out what effect these had on running economy and perceived exertion in recreational runners.
Yeah, I think like dynamic stretching, like, it doesn't get the same bad press as static stretching, does it, before a run? And you see most people doing their sort of like leg kicks and all that kind of stuff. And in fairness, in the study, like, dynamic stretching was shown to work as well. So I think if you're at all dubious about it, between the two of them, dynamic stretching would be the one to stick with. But it's interesting that actually static stretching, which, you know, a lot of people, I think you would, running coaches or people involved with running would be like, oh, don't be static stretching before you run. That you're going to like make things worse. Actually, perhaps that isn't actually really true. So
I think it's personal too, isn't it? Like, we've all heard me bang on about my sciatic nerve enough, haven't we, to never hear about that again. But like, I know that if that's really bad, which it is every now and again, I have to kind of do stuff before I run. But if it's not bad, I'll just get up, walk the dog, and then go for a run. And my one of the top 10 least favorite things in the world about running is that when you go to a race and they make you do that warm-up, like, literally...
like a crowd-driven musical.
Drop me out. I have to go and stand on the side because it makes me want to be sick. So, like, that, you know what I mean? It's like, I don't think there's a right or wrong. And, like, if you do that kind of pre-race warm-up before every run, I have so much respect for you, but that's bonkers. Like, do you know what I mean? There's not... I don't think
it's a time thing. I do a dynamic little stretchy routine before I head out, but it's minutes of just, like, thinking about the muscles that I'm going to be using.
Yeah, I can imagine you doing that, Ben, though. That's very you, isn't it?
It's old, Jane. It's just age.
No, it's because you're like very... you'll think about what muscles you're going to use.
Well, the thing about the muscles that I'll try and use is probably...
I feel like Rick's just padding around his house barefoot 24/7, so he's already warmed up.
Well, that's true, but I got into this... I'll put a link in the show notes, but there's the Ethiopian warm-up, which is really big.
Rick's had me doing this. He's had me doing this.
They're a group, and they're always in a line, and they're kind of copying each other all in a line. There's like maybe 10 or 15 runners doing a variety of incredible dynamic stretches, and it looks absolutely amazing. So I'll put a link to that, because that's, if you're going to warm up, that's the way to do it in style.
It was good. We did it in the basement at work. We actually, me and Rick did a bit of it. Did a bit of this.
That's cute.
And it was.
Can that be in the?
Can we film that next
time? A little video.
Yeah, sure.
Surrounded by all the bikes in the lockers.
Yeah, exactly. So that's my sort of, definitely that's my sort of warm up. I like a sort of move. If I'm sweating a little bit before I start running, that's
good.
That's the kind of warm up I like.
I agree.
Yeah.
Right, Jane. Okay. Hit us with yours.
Yeah. Runners should lift light weights and do lots of reps. This is controversial. I already know this is a controversial one. The science says that runners should actually lift heavy and go for somewhere between 6 and 10 reps. And even just doing this once a week has been shown to build enough kind of strength and then maintain it. I've gone through it all, haven't I? I don't love the gym, so I feel like this is one where I am immediately want to unsubscribe from that site. But I do like the idea of doing like 10 squats with a heavy weight once a week, and that be enough. But I feel like I've twisted that fact to make it work for me, and that's not what the science probably says. But I don't know. I think there are two schools of thoughts, aren't there? There's the people that, I don't know, do CrossFit and then run a 3-hour marathon, and that's amazing for them. And then there are runners who hate the gym, and maybe somewhere in the middle is the best kind of person.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I think it gets into that kind of argument between like what's best practice, and is best practice actually something that's practical for people? So is lifting heavy weights really heavy, like 6 to 10 reps, actually is pretty heavy, and you need some fairly heavy weights at home or in the gym to do it. Is prescribing that to people actually helpful, or would be better off saying any strength training is better than none?
And yes
maybe lifting heavy is ideal,
and
but yeah,
you know, maybe this is one for the joy plan. Do what makes you happy. If you love going to the gym, go to the gym, enjoy it. But if you're like me and you avoid the gym like the plague, then just do some Pilates or do something that is kind of strengthening muscles, so you're not just running. I guess that's the myth thing here, isn't it? You should do something other than just run all the time.
Runners should lift heavy, I think, and lower reps, because simply the adaptations that brings to muscles is different to running and like cardio, and light weights with loads of reps is kind of just like endurance stuff, where you need to do the heavier stuff because that is what helps muscles, you know, grow, get stronger. I mean, make it interesting and dynamic and suited to running. Like, you're not just talking going to the gym and just trying to, you know, bench press something insane, because it's not really like important. But I do think that like things like deadlifts, certain squat variations like split squats and stuff, basically things that sort of mimic running but under like greater duress, is where the muscles get a whole different type of workout, and that's what aids like stability, strength, power, all that sort of stuff, rather than basically kind of replicating muscles under duress from running but in a gym scenario. I think
science would definitely back that up, Ben. Yeah,
I guess it's
just about, you know, Does telling people to lift heavy, how many people do you lose at that point when you say that?
That's progressive, isn't it?
Like that's subjective, isn't it?
Yeah, heavy can be whatever it is. Like, if you start off 6 to 10 reps and 5 kilos is all you can do, and like physically, which could be the case for someone, then that's heavy, and you just get stronger and you build and you add more and more weight. There's obviously a start point to this. No one's going to rock up to the gym and start doing 100 kilo whatevers. Like, all right, no,
the caber toss.
Yeah. All right, I better get in here and just like my body weight, just immediately smash that out. But I think that's a good one to sort of just put to one side.
All right, number four, the idea that 80-20 doesn't work on lower mileage. Obviously, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago with Tom Craggs.
I mean, just literally just link in description.
Just link into it. Yeah. But this study showed that, club runners who are running 10K under 40 minutes, just under 40 minutes, and they one group followed an 80-20 and the other followed a 50-50 ratio. So 50-50 being like half easy, half hard running. Mm. On 30 miles a week, which obviously isn't like super low mileage, but possibly is low mileage for like sort of club running types.
Yeah.
And it found that after 10 weeks, the 80-20 group's time improved by 5%, and while the 50-50 group improved by only 3.6. So it still works at low, and maybe it still works even at lower mileage than that. So it's one that isn't just for the elites. And I think that's often what people worry about, is that, well, you know, unless I'm running 60 miles a week, does it really work? And actually it does.
There we go. I mean, I think this is just us now appearing like we have an agenda to push the 80-20 method.
Are we sponsored by 80-20? Yeah.
Yeah. If there was a brand exclusively called 80-20, welcome to the 80-20 podcast. But no, it's, you know, it does seem like a very logical way of training in my head. Like, make sure that quality is there and the rest of the time just work on that base. Like, it's just, otherwise you're just, I don't know, maybe I'm just talking to someone who has limited amount of energetic resource.
And so, I guess for someone who didn't listen to the Tom Craggs one, 80-20 would be 30 miles a week. You'd do 6 miles at a really kind of tough pace and the rest of the miles that week would be chilled.
Exactly.
That's
what
we're talking about,
isn't it? So it's like that kind of, it's very similar to sort of polarized training. So like, 80% really easy, 20% really quite hard, and nothing or very little in the mid zone.
Yeah.
It's looked at as being a very sustainable way of training as well, because I think very slow running is less likely to get you injured or knackered than that kind of steady state or even like tempo-y running that is can be quite hard work on the body.
Yeah. All right. Okay, the much celebrated negative split is the best way to run every distance, every race. Negative split is the best way to do it. Negative split is obviously, for anyone who knows, if you take whatever distance it is and divide it by half, you run the second half faster than the first half, which is harder. Yeah. There's another pacing strategy that may lead to a better result, and it's called the controlled fade. This doesn't mean setting off at a ridiculous pace and then hang on for dear life, but expecting some tail off in the second half. It might be a tactic worth trying at your next park run, just sort of, you know, set off knowing that it's going to be hard and then just adjust for a little drop off in pace towards the end. One study found that completing the first mile, 1.62 kilometers, of a 5K race between 3-6% faster than the average race pace yielded the best results, right? So there's something. And then when it comes to the marathon, there are obviously more severe consequences for not setting off at race pace. Another study found that running the first 5K segment 10% faster than race pace adds about 37 minutes to the average finish time, while starting 10% slower adds about 29 minutes, and most PBs came from running the first 5K at goal race pace.
It's quite a lot to unpack there, isn't there?
I was reading that, and because that's quite a lot to
The 5K one is interesting, though, because this negative split thing, it gets held up, doesn't it, as like the holy grail, and it's like, that's what everyone should be doing. I think that with a negative split, unless you are like an elite runner or you absolutely nail it, like you say, that there's a chance that actually what you've done is run slightly slower than you could have done overall in the first half, because I reckon most people run their best marathon time, or certainly 5K time, when they probably go through halfway just a little bit quicker, and then they hang on, because in some ways then that's a very honest way to run, because you then can't quite get the pace you're trying to do, so you kind of know that you've given it everything within reason. Whereas with a negative split, maybe you just went off a little too slowly in the first half and allowed that negative split to happen, but it wasn't actually your best performance as a result.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What do you think, Jane?
I mean, guys, I don't want to brag. I've run 2 negative split marathons.
We all know what Rick thinks.
We all know what you think of that, Rick. Thanks for, you know, shitting on my performance.
Maybe you know.
No, I don't know. Do you know what? I think because I've always had a problem. Well, I've had a problem where I go off too quick, and I think a lot of runners probably do. And if you, I think for me, obviously I'm not an elite runner or even a club runner or any sort of quick runner at all, am I? But for me, it was just a way of controlling that in the first half and controlling that, and then thinking, right, now I can pick it up. But I do think if we're talking fast running, I completely get. I also wonder if it's like, not to be sexist, but I know that men are probably better going out too quick and then holding on, whereas I don't know if men are good at slowing down. I think there's a lot of ego, isn't there?
Yes.
You have to let people go. And that's the worst part of trying to, with the negative split thing. I remember Lewis saying to me before, Lewis, who was my coach at the time, saying, you've just got to let people go and trust that you'll overtake them in the second half. You really feel like you're almost holding yourself back. And it's a lot of ego there. But then equally, who knows? Maybe I'll do another marathon and just bomb off the line and see what happens to compare. But I think my problem was I would bomb off the line, run way too quick, and then not be able to hold on and end up walking bits and mentally giving up and just having a horrible time. So I guess there's a place for it.
I think that the controlled fade, the hardest bit of that is the mental bit, the feeling, because as you say, Jane, when you're talking about the controlled negative split, you kind of it gives you a semblance of like you know how you're going to go at the beginning, and then you know when to turn up, you know, and you've got this managed effort, whereas a controlled fade sounds slightly more liable to sort of just
destructing.
Yeah, and like that feeling of there's nothing worse than feeling getting towards the end of a race and feeling like the performance is dropping, which is normal. But you kind of, you know what I mean, like it's quite demoralizing when you get that sort of, I suppose if you work around a strategy based on a control fade, then your efforts will be different, and you get familiar with what feels like an okay decrease versus a sort of
plummet.
A plummet. Yeah, exactly. A drop off a cliff sort of stuff. But yeah, I think there is a slight sort of like a mental challenge of getting over, or a psychological challenge to get over the idea of going slower and the pace dropping off a bit, but that being okay, and you'll still get there in the end.
Yeah, and it's interesting that it seems to be a tactic that works probably best over 5K, maybe 10K, whereas the marathon stuff around trying to get that first 5 kilometres roughly around your kind of average race pace goal.
That's hard as well, because the race is always so busy at the start.
Mm-hmm.
Like, then it's the stress of that. Like, I've got to, I don't know. Anyway, I like it though. I think that the negative split is definitely not the best for everyone.
Yeah, it's good to think of like there's different ways, lots of ways to skin a cat kind of thing, isn't there? Like a positive split gets like, it's a bit like a heel strike, like gets a lot of bad press, whereas maybe there's versions of this where actually it's not the worst tactic.
Also, there's got to be numbers out there of people who positive split versus negative split, and I would say that positive split is the overwhelming majority.
I agree. I think most people with marathon PBs will be a small positive split, maybe sort of 2 or 3 minutes. Certainly amateur runners anyway.
Yeah.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door.
Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Right, who's next? Is it Jane?
It's me.
Talking about...
It's me.
Right, next one.
Here we go. Compede. Compede is the best way to treat a blister. I mean, I don't like talking about feet, so I'm really gutted I've got this one. But we included a long article. If you do like talking and reading about feet, there's a long article.
If you're really into feet,
If you're really into feet, you do you, hon. And there's a long article on the history of the blister, which sounds fascinating. And the writer spoke with two people who help out at mile 55 of the Western States 100. And they are foot care experts, John Vonhoff and Tonya Olsen. Big respect for you both. Their weapon of choice is tape, ideally a woven product like K-tape, and they avoid Compede. And do you know what? I have heard this before. Cause I think the Compede, from my very basic knowledge of just using them, is put on top of the blister and it's designed to stay there until the blister or the skin underneath is healed and not be painful. But obviously, that's great if you're just like flip-flopping around in a Birkenstock. But if you're putting pressure on that being inside a shoe, I've always thought that a Compede is then almost rubbing the skin more. So I can get on board with this. And I have used tape before and I think it works better. But then, I don't know. I think
you're right, Jane. I remember talking with, remember Mark Thornbury, who is a great ultra runner, nice bloke. And he was good enough to help me out when I did an ultramarathon. One of the first things he said was, what are you going to do about blisters? And I was like, I've got some Compede. And he's like, no. He advised Leukotape, which is basically the same, like very similar to K-tape. And I used it after about 15 miles and it was brilliant. It absolutely just sorted it out. And it was like, I would, and it's so inexpensive as well. We're not talking about sort of a huge investment here. It's like about £7 to go and buy some Leukotape. And it lasts for about, I only bought one roll and it was about 5 years ago. So it's like, it's worth experimenting with, I think.
I also think it's worth... Because I had blisters, I remember having blisters really badly in the first marathon, and it was just vile, absolutely vile. And I just think I was probably running in the wrong shoes and the wrong socks. But I think if you are getting blisters, if you're not an ultra marathon runner because you're insane and you don't care about your feet, if you're a beginner and you're getting loads and loads of blisters, probably look at why, because it's not normal, is it, to be plagued with blisters for months and months and months on end.
No.
You should probably have a look.
Do you think that your feet got tougher though?
I do think so. That's true, maybe.
Touch wood, have absolutely never been blisters have never been a problem. Only like testing random shoes that don't fit my feet properly. That's the only time.
One thing that comes up is that there are some surprising things that, like, so if you're dehydrated, you're much more likely to get a blister. So you can do certain things like staying hydrated can make you less blister prone. Is it me or is it Ben?
It's me, mate. Go ahead.
Super shoes only make a difference if you're super quick. And it's probably quite easy to think that, isn't it? Because they were made for the sub-2 marathon. But there's some research that suggests actually the bigger gains are if you're not as quick. Partly, I think... I'm not very good at maths, and there's a little bit more maths to this than this. But essentially, if you're getting a 4% improvement on a 4-hour time, that's obviously more minutes than if you're going to run 2.5 hours. And it still seems to hold. So it's not like people like amateur runners who are running 4 hours, 5 hours are still getting that kind of improvement. And it maybe feels a bit counterintuitive because you'd imagine like the kind of gait cycle that these were created for was extremely different to for if you're running really quickly or you're running. More towards the back of the pack, but it makes the shoes much more applicable for people, doesn't it? Because it could seem like, oh, look, these only work if you're running 5-minute miles, but it doesn't seem to be the case. Do you disagree, Ben?
I mean, it's hard to disagree. I guess it's always tricky to know the sample in Boulder, Colorado Boulder. Everyone loves running over there, so it's kind of, I don't know. I don't know if it's kind of perhaps... I just don't want to quite buy into all the marketing around those shoes, basically, because they are obviously phenomenal and they do a lot of stuff, but it adds a whole world of like issues for me in terms of like cost of running. I don't know. I just find it hard to sort of also really believe that the 4% performance difference that the shoes are sort of given can be across the board for everyone. I just don't think that that's going to be the case. So I can kind of like see where the science comes from and take, like, obviously they're going to improve a lot of people's running and they'll make a huge difference to those who are chasing PBs. And, you know, if they train super hard, then why not have that extra element that might well be the thing that seals the deal for them? I just find it hard to sort of like quantify that. Every single shoe with that carbon plate in it, that carbon plate behaves in the same way for every single person. And, you know, I'm a bigger guy, so the amount of compression that I put through the foam and through the shoe is the same as someone who's 20 kilos lighter than me, and da-da-da-da-da, and all these things. Like,
I can see both sides here. I can see that, and I think if you're a run walker or you're a complete beginner, spending £300 on a running coach would be such a better thing to do than spending £300 on a pair of shoes. I 100% agree with that. But I also think there's a psychological thing about putting these super shoes on. Like, I think just having, and that's why I always say to people, like, buy kit that you really feel great in and wear that for a marathon. Sure, you might have a comfier pair of shorts, but if you feel great, that will affect how you perform, won't it? So I think if you're going out there and you're buying these Vaporflies or you're buying these shoes and you think, God, these look cool, and the guys at the front of the race are wearing these, there is something in that. But I think I agree. I don't know. I do think, like, I think people have messaged me saying, I'm doing my first marathon, I'm going for, you know, sub-5. Do I have to buy those? Because I feel like it's a thing now that everyone has to buy a racing shoe. And it's like, no, like, we were all running before these shoes existed. People were running really fast before these shoes existed. And I don't think it's something you have to do.
They're not a necessity. Yeah.
No. And actually, if you do have that cash, spend it on like 5 sessions with a running coach, and you'd probably get so much more out of that, wouldn't you, than a pair of shoes?
Definitely. Definitely.
I've probably benefited so much more training with a coach. It's made me such a better runner than buying a pair of shoes. Like, the shoes haven't made the difference in the time, the coaching has, for sure. Yeah. But that's a personal opinion, I think.
I mean, it's a really good point. Yeah, I think it's a really good point. Well, we've got one more, haven't we?
Oh. Nice, controversial.
This is controversial. I'm going to just immediately...
I'm throwing this one in there. I'm going to bat this one up. I'm sure I'm right.
Yeah, yeah. There's absolutely no doubt that I'm not explaining first and foremost that this is Rick's one.
Yeah, this is Rick. This is Rick, and Rick alone came up with this.
No.
Right. Running your best ultra is hold on, Rick. Is not necessarily harder than running your best 5K?
Oh, no. I've said that the wrong belief is that running your best ultra is necessarily harder than running your best 5K.
So the myth that needs busting is that running your best ultra is necessarily harder than running your best 5K. So,
yes.
Just to explain that, running... Rick has put this
Rick
in there.
Rick believes.
Rick Pearson of this podcast believes that running a... hard running your best 5K, your fastest, your hardest 5K, is harder than running an ultra.
Not necessarily harder, but not necessarily easier.
Right.
And I think there's also a belief that I think is even more true, is that people think that going further is harder, and it isn't. And people who say, "Oh, my mates run a 50 miler, he's twice as fit as you because you've only run a marathon." This belief exists. And
well,
exists.
I mean, first of all, that person's maths is atrocious. But I know what you mean.
But you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah,
it's
yeah.
like, oh, your greatest achievement must be the furthest that you've run. And we're still obsessed with distance, and we really undervalue or underestimate how hard it is to run your best race for 5Ks, 10Ks, halves, even stuff like a mile. It's extremely difficult. It's extremely painful.
So maybe
it can
the myth,
be more painful than running an ultra, for sure.
So maybe the myth should be that ultra runners...
Yeah, going further running, isn't harder.
Ultra running is the hardest type of running.
I think that's very related, isn't it? Ultra running can be some of the easiest type of running.
If you're
taking photographs, sitting down a lot, enjoying it, maybe running with someone who's not as good as you are. I've done an ultra marathon like that, and it was certainly nowhere near as hard as the best 10K that I've run. I'm not saying that to be obscure or to be sort of like provocative or anything.
What was it you said when I logged on the other week? You said, "Is 200 miles a new 100 miles?" Is that related to this point? Because I feel like you have weird ideas about ultras, and I just want to clarify that on the podcast.
No, that's a different idea that I'm putting forward. That 200 is a new 100.
Okay, so we're
that sort of like far end of extreme stuff that's happening.
100's too easy these days. Running. That's what he said.
Just to share that with the listeners.
Do you agree that to a certain extent that we overestimate the difficulty that distance brings,
and we
underestimate what intensity.
I do, because I think I could go out and run. I reckon I could go and run 30 miles on Saturday and do 10 miles, stop, have a lunch, have a break, eat some food,
walk a bit,
chat with some people, run another 10 miles, stop, have a big break, run a 5 miles, stop, walk 5 miles. Technically, yes, I've run an ultra. But have I actually run an ultra? Do you know what I mean? I feel like there's ultra gets like tricky. It's got a tricky thing with it, hasn't it?
You've described almost like a very common tactic to ultra running, and that would be the tactic that I use, which was like, a run walk strategy. That's kind of what almost everyone does, and that's just the best way to get to finish. But what that means is, yes, there can be accumulation of pain, but there's possibly not. There's not the intensity of pain that you're going to get in shorter distances. It's not to say that it's necessarily easier, but I don't think it means it's necessarily harder either. And someone you might think, I've only run a 5K. I'm nowhere near as good as someone who's run a half marathon. It sort of depends what that 5K looked like for you and what that person's half marathon looked like for them. It's not as simple as just like the distance alone doesn't tell you how hard something is.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean,
God,
I'm not a huge distance.
You've converted us, Rick. Look at this. Me and Ben were like, no, you're wrong, and now we're all on the same page.
No. I think that we're talking about a different myth. I think the way that the phrasing of the original was a bit contentious, but I think what we're talking about is
we've all agreed.
I know what you mean, Ben. Yeah.
I would agree that the perceived exertion is very different for these different things, and there's like time on feet, and there's like the waves of psychological like doubt and whatever that come from distance stuff when you're kind of like, I'm gonna stop now and I give up and this is too hard, da, 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 da. There's not really enough time in those other races for that. It's all just sort of like, it's kind of more just you're just basically on the edge of like aerobic capacity, and that's horrible. Like, that's a horrible feeling, and that's why those races are just so kind of like cutthroat, because you're kind of just like, all right, I've got to hold on now for as long as for this set amount of time, and then it stops. You know, then that I know that bit of suffering's gonna stop. Whereas ultras kind of, it ebbs and flows, doesn't it? Like, you're kind of like, there's a hard bit and then an easier bit and then a harder bit, and then but then you're in your head for so long because you're just endlessly going, oh my God, this is hard, isn't it? Oh, I've got another 40 miles to go. So I guess it's whatever bit of running you find harder. Like, because I think I could sit in my own head and suffer for a fair old time. But I think that the shorter stuff is harder sometimes, because if you're going flat out and you really are, I don't know. Actually, I don't know. I'm convincing myself. I'm going around in circles and convincing myself on both arguments as I speak. But no, I agree. So I 100% agree that perhaps, I 100% agree that the distance stuff is given more credit than it should be. in terms of hardness.
It's funny that because I know like one of the arguments against it would be like, look, you only say you're running your best 5K and say that for you means it's 25 minutes, and you'd be like, you know, after 10 minutes you've only got to hang on for 15 minutes. You'd be surprised how little consolation that is when you're running your best 5K. The idea of having to run 15 minutes isn't, that's not great. Like the idea of having to run for another 3 or 4 minutes when you're running flat out 5K is actually seems insurmountable. So
that's true. Yeah.
These kind of distances get stretched when you're really trying, and it isn't like, oh, I've only got one kilometer left, I'll be all right.
Yeah, that,
if you've ever done anything on a track, 400 meters changes every lap. Like that's not the same distance every time you go around a track. Gosh, guys, we've just busted some myths.
Oh, there's some myth busting went on there.
Or made some worse. I'm not sure.
Amazing amount of myth busting, and it's funny, isn't it? Because even as a free, we don't really agree on everything, and I think that's just running, isn't it? And your own kind of experience and stuff.
Yeah, we're three very different runners.
That's true.
Yeah. True.
And
true.
200 miles isn't the new 100 miles, but if you if you agree with Rick, let us know, because there must be people out there, Rick. There must be people like you. I'm not saying you're a lone wolf.
Right. So I think this is it. So podcast@runnersworld.co.uk. What you thought about these myths? What other myths we should visit in perhaps myth busting version 2?
Part 2.
Yeah, exactly, because it's going to happen.
Yeah, what do you want us to talk about next? Please, please, no more blister chat. But what, you know, maybe that's what the people want.
Any other myths out there, running myths that you want busting, just send them our way, as that's what we do best. But yeah, I think that was good.
All right. Well, that brings us to the end of this week's Runners World podcast. Thanks very much for listening. And thanks to very special guests, Jane and Ben as well, for coming on. Much appreciated.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much
for
having me.
You are welcome.
You can subscribe to all sorts of Runners World things on the internet, be it the magazine or a newsletter, or just come to the website, runnersworld.com/UK, to get some running information. All the social channels @RunnersWorldUK.
And you can listen to the Runners World podcast on Acast, iTunes, all of the best podcast apps out there. Search Runners World UK and do click subscribe. And thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next week.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.